This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hi, everyone, and this is Greg Gazin, and welcome to the latest edition of the Toastmasters podcast. We have an exciting show for you. Our speaker today is Greg Van Borsum. He's a motivational speaker and a strategic thought leader. He has a dynamic personality and quickly becoming a high sought-after resource in business and professional circles, from athletes and small business owners to Fortune 500 companies. He was the world's youngest professional natural bodybuilder by age 20, a finalist at three Mr. Universe competitions by age 21, a multiple black belt martial artist having trained at the Shaolin Temple in China and in Australia, a multi-state, national, and world shooting champion, and a member of the state and national shooting teams. Now, if that wasn't enough, Greg soon turned his sights on a filmmaking career, where he quickly rose through the ranks as a writer-director, eventually becoming a digital crowds and a motion capture director on the Academy Award-winning film Happy Feet, Happy Feet 2, and most recently as a fight choreographer and weapons advisor on the new Mad Max Fury Road, where he trained some of Hollywood's finest. He's also a Toastmaster, having recently won, I believe, a speech competition. And his journey is certainly one of inspiration. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you, Greg?
I'm pretty good. So it's interesting, when I read the article, there was a phenomenal article on you in the January edition of the Toastmasters magazine. It's ironic because one of the movies that you've worked on was Happy Feet. Happy Feet happened to be on the next day, so I got to watch it and enjoyed Mumble and everything else. Your journey is really one of inspiration, and you've accomplished many things, and in many respects, you're a jack of all trades, but yet you're also a master of all. Where did you get the inspiration to do these things, and even beginning at such a young age?
I mean, I was labeled as a failure at school, and it actually took my parents, of all people. Like, my father was a great inspiration. Dad was a world record holding kayaker. He came to Australia from New Zealand with a dream and $500 and managed to make a life here, where he met my mother. So he's been the greatest inspiration in my life physically, because he taught me and actually said to me, if you want to do something in life, you go after it until you get it and don't stop. There's never a stop in between. You just go for it. And so that's what I put into practice. I put into practice going for what I wanted, and actually taking the first step has always been my major variant between, I suppose, other people, is that I'm always prepared to take the first step regardless of what happens at the other end.
Now, in the article, it says that you immersed yourself in training. I mean, you started bodybuilding at age 13 and you were self-motivated. How did that come about?
I was a really skinny kid, and I started martial arts at a very young age, and I always found that I was weaker than the other kids. And so I decided that I needed to change that. So I started weight training, and very quickly I immersed myself in the sport. And the reason I had to do that is because no one would help me. I used to ask the guy that ran the fitness center for help, and they never had time for me. And so I had to learn my, I thought, if I'm going to learn this, then I need to learn it myself. And so I immersed myself in everything I could possibly find, information-wise, videos, every book, every magazine I could get my hands on. I would just, and I'd watch people. I just studied everything so I could know how to become a champion at that.
It sounds like the classic, someone kicked the sand in my face, so therefore I'm now going to turn the tables on them.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you that what started it for me is probably the strongest point, is that very fact. When I bought my first magazine, I was 13 years of age. I saw a photograph of a bodybuilder called Bob Paris, whose physique was like a statue. And I got so excited by this, and I'm like 15 kilos wringing wet. And I jumped up to my friend's house, and I just announced that I was going to be the national champion of this country, because Bob had just won the national US titles. And they looked at the photo of him and then looked at me, and they thought it was the most hilarious thing I'd ever come out with. And they belittled me so much that I grabbed my bag and I left their house. I went back to the gym and sat on the bench and just looked at the photographs of the champions on the wall and just thought, you know what, I'm going to be that. And that was the change. When I actually won the national championships at 20, I went back to their place. I hadn't been there for years, and I knocked on the door and gave his mother the trophy and walked off.
Wow. At 20, so you won the heavyweight champion for Australia at that time at 20?
Yes, I did. I won the teenage division at 17. And I didn't win a show for years. I went to my first show. I had no idea what to do. My magazines here were black and white. I didn't realize bodybuilders wore fake tan. I'm white as a ghost the best of times. So I walk out on stage and people are giggling at me. So it was a great start point. I didn't even tell my parents I was going to the show. So I had a friend take me there. I got on stage, didn't know anything about the sport, but that was the start. Even though people thought it was quite funny that I was up there white as a ghost and no idea, I thought that was I'd begun the journey, and that was the start of it all for me. And I just kept coming back, and I didn't win a show until I was, you know, my the teenage nationals. I eventually came from fifth to fourth to third to second, and then won the teenage nationals, and then took my way through to finally going for the national titles. But see, a week out from the nationals, I smashed my knee under the leg press. It literally folded sideways under about 2,000 pounds, and the doctors told me everything was lost. And I managed to get a sports doctor friend of mine to work out a way to get me on stage, which is to basically slide a 19.5-gauge needle under my kneecap every day and drain out 2.5 cups of fluid, ice it, and let me go back to the gym to train. And it was excruciating. But I got out on stage that next weekend and I won the nationals by 1 point.
Wow. And then, of course, the Mr. Universe competition.
My aim was for the nationals. Once I'd won the nationals, I was actually, that was the dream completed. The universe was just cherry, you know, like the cherry on the cake. I mean, I became the world's youngest pro at 20. And I went to 3 Mr. Universes by the age of 22 and decided to take on other endeavors using the same mindset.
So what was it like being on the stage at the Mr. Universe competition?
It was amazing because I finally got to stand on stage at 20 with the people I'd been reading about. And just to be there was just such a thrill because I felt like I'd actually changed a lot of things in life. And then to place in the top 6 in the competition out of 120 competitors was fantastic. My first time there, my first time traveling overseas was to the USA, which is where the first show was. You know, it was a brilliant to get the award medals to the top 6. So I got this fantastic dinner plate size medal, which bodybuilding gives everything oversized. I was in love with the whole moment and the time of being there. And I put so much work into posing. I believed that the bodybuilding was about the show you gave for the audience. And it had to be something fantastic. And I got the best posing routine in every competition I ever entered after that first massive failure when I walked on stage with no idea. I decided to put the work into becoming the best prepared athlete around. And I even won the best posing award at the Mr. Universe. And the audience never made a sound until the end. It was quite an amazing feeling.
Your success in bodybuilding also led to your first opportunity to speak in public.
Yeah, well, not speak in public could be the thing to say. At dinner, after winning my second Mr. Australia, I went to dinner with my parents to a local Chinese restaurant. And at the end of dinner, they gave us these fortune cookies. Well, as I opened my fortune cookie, I felt the world slowing down because I saw this little message float down to the table. And what was written on it is like a 20-year-old's worst nightmare. And it said, listen to your mother's advice. And I quickly tried to hide it before Mum could see it, but she'd already spotted it. And she leans across the table to me and she just looked at me because Mum had come from a very hard upbringing. And it was actually Toastmistress, which is the ladies' version that used to exist, Toastmasters, that got her through. And she leant across the table to me and said, look, if I can give you one piece of advice, it's this, go to Toastmasters and learn to speak. Of course, I shrugged it off. I thought it was a joke. I said, well, I've been on stage for 4 or 5 years walking the boards in front of massive crowds. I don't need Toastmasters. What are you talking about? Lo and behold, I get back from the Mr. Universe competition in Italy, and there's a message on the answering machine at home saying, oh, we'd like you to come and keynote speak at our graduation at the end of your high school. So I think, oh, great, bit of notoriety. I'll do it for sure. And I got up on stage that night in front of about 500 or more people, and I froze. I didn't know what to say. I hadn't prepared. I didn't understand the process involved in actually having to speak in front of people, which was very different from the physicality of posing in front of people. And it took me about 2 minutes. I didn't know who was going to speak first, the audience to get me off or me. So I eventually eked out a few words, and the whole time looking for the quickest exit to leave there and never go back. And I didn't speak again on stage until I joined Toastmasters last year.
So I guess you were still wondering what a keynote speech was after you said, sure, I'll do a keynote speech.
Well, I managed to condense a 45-minute speech into about a 3-minute gobble. It was great.
So I guess, Greg, you didn't take your mother's advice at the time and join Toastmasters.
No, and I think the onstage deflation of me put me back a number of years, which is a shame. I would have loved to have kept going, but I just didn't understand the process that was required. But eventually when I decided to get into movies and filmmaking, like I had no experience. I was a carpenter. I decided to have a crack at making films, and no one wanted to know about me. So I thought, well, what do I do? So I set up my own film company. So I had to learn to start speaking to people somehow.
Where was the point where the light really came on?
It wasn't until a life event happened that I realized that I actually had to speak. And that was the difference. I mean, I can speak to people, and most people can. But when it comes to actually imparting knowledge on people from a teaching perspective, or from the basis of you feel you've got something worthwhile that the world needs to hear, that's when you learn that you can speak, because you have to speak. And it's got to come from inside you. It can't be this superficial thing. And I learned that through a life-changing event. You know, I grew up in a rough area. Quite a few of my friends didn't make it. They either went to prison or they killed themselves. And it was rough. It wasn't until we had a big issue with the Mad Max, our latest film. We had a big issue with that. And it put us in a very tough place, my family and I, financially. And we struggled a lot. And I had to go back to an industry for a while that I never wanted to go back into, which was the construction industry. And it was a hard hit going from working with Hollywood A-list actors to the bottom, basically shoveling dirt for months in the bottom of a lift shaft in knee-deep mud. I love the hard work, don't get me wrong. I treat it all as training. But it was the effect I saw that that world was having on the other people that worked there. And it wasn't until one of the days, one of my work colleagues jumped to his death. And I'd been through so many of these things in my life. I decided that I needed to say something. So I got up and spoke for half an hour to these guys about how this happens, how quickly it can happen, how life can change so badly in such a short period of time. But then the ramifications of that, when you do take that action, you know, it can decimate hundreds of people. That was the first event I'd spoken at, and it saved a lot of lives, because what happened at the end of that speech, I said to all the workers, and there was about 1,000 of them, I said, if anyone else is feeling the same way, please come and see me. I will get you help now myself. And 6 people came up to me and said, we've been thinking of killing ourselves. And for all different reasons, drug addiction, some had gambling problems. I think that day we lost one life, but we saved 6. And that was the first time I realized that I had something worth to talk about.
Wow. So just to be clear, so you worked on Happy Feet, and then you worked on the Happy Feet 2 movie. Then you started working on the Mad Max Fury Road. And then I understand that the filming stopped for some reason. Is that what happened?
Yeah, we had, you know, like most films, you have, you know, there's always something doesn't go to plan. And so we had a hold up for a while, and it put us, we'd committed to various things and just put us in a tough spot. And we have to keep, you know, you have to keep money coming into the house. And so we had to keep working. So I had to change industries for a while until things got cleared up and it got back on track. You know, thankfully it did. And the film looks amazing. I mean, it really does. And we've poured so many years of work into this film. I started on Mad Max in 1999. You know, it's gone on and off between the Penguin films because of, you know, various things, the war, the dollar changing. You know, with filmmaking, things don't always go as planned. And so it didn't. So we had to deal with the ramifications of that and make ends meet whilst things were getting fixed up.
So what was the point where you said to yourself, I have to join Toastmasters?
It was straight after that, that incident on site. This is one thing I'll tell you as a point for everyone out there. If you want to be a speaker, you've got to let people in. If you don't let people into your heart and into your life, then no one actually understands you. And if people don't understand you, they'll never believe you. So for me, it's a big thing about allowing people in to know what I was going through, what I was feeling. And yeah, it took me to a very low point. I mean, I'd worked for so many years. I had to teach myself Mandarin. I had to go and set up a film company. I had to go and work in China and Hong Kong trying to break in. It all went pear-shaped. I had to come back again and start again. All that stuff to make a film career, it took 15 years to get in because I was a non-experienced filmmaker. I had to teach myself to make movies. I ended up winning the New York Film Festival for Best Action Short Film. It got me recognized, but it took so much work of living with just your own promise to yourself that you could do it when no one else believed in you. And it, you know, it was all of that work had just gone when everything fell down, and it took me to a dark place. And it does that. My wife was really worried about me. And I mean, I would go to work and some days and not know whether I'd probably come back. And it took me sitting on the bed next to my 2 kids one morning when they were sleeping to realize that I had something worth fighting for. That was the change. When I realized that I needed to give back and needed to grow, I started studying speakers. I started listening to some of the great motivational speakers. I started looking at video footage of them so I could see their movements, their gestures, all of that stuff that is so critical to getting a message across, and then having some content in your speaking that's just not fluff. I mean, you've got to speak from the heart. You've got to speak with reality and truth. And if you can do that, you'll engage with people. And so I started doing that. And so I needed to go to Toastmasters to learn the skill sets. And Toastmasters has been such a great learning curve for all of that, because I feel Toastmasters teaches you the essentials that no one else seems to teach. It's been one of the greatest influences, not just on my life, but on many.
So, Greg, when did you actually join Toastmasters then?
November 2013.
And where is your club? And I understand it wasn't very close to home.
You know, I'm a member of Sea Eagles Toastmasters, and it was close to home when I first joined, but we were in the process of selling our house. We sold our house 1 month after I joined the club. At the time, we were possibly 10 minutes from the club. Now we're 240-kilometer round trip from the club, so... But I still go there because the people are fantastic. The energy at our club is phenomenal. Everybody's striving to be better. We've got some fantastic mentors in the club that have been members of Toastmasters for 40 plus years. They're a great guiding light. As much as we heckle them, they're a great guiding light to us, but don't tell them that. The reason I go to that club is it's the club that I started at. It's the club that changed me. It's the club that helped me so much in so many ways, and everyone's so dedicated that I continue to go there. The trip doesn't faze me. I'm prepared to drive an hour and a half each way to go there. Yeah, it's just how it is because I love the place.
I'll have to let people know who don't like to change clubs because they moved to the other side of the river.
It's a journey, but it's fun. That's where I practice my speeches, in the car. I record them on my iPhone and I play them back to myself on the drive so I can get it better before I get there.
So you're continuing your Toastmasters journey, even though you're working on a speaking career?
I've got some great things to do with Toastmasters. There's the speaking competitions, which I love. When I found out they had a speaking competition in Toastmasters, I was there because I love competing in things. I finally just last week won our club's international speaking contest as well as the evaluation contest. I wasn't able to do it last year because I didn't qualify. I hadn't done enough speeches. So now that I've done the minimum six, I've got the right to go for it. So I'm now at the next level, which starts in another week or so. And I've got an aim of trying to get to the world titles one day, you know. But my speeches will be different from most people's because I speak slightly, I don't know, a bit more raw, I suppose. And, you know, they may or may not like that. I don't know, but it's just how I am and I have to speak true to me. So I'll always compete and always speak for Toastmasters because it is such a great, fantastic federation and organization, you know. So the speaking career was bounced off that. I mean, our aim with our speaking company is to give back. I mean, we've got some of the highest achievers you could ever imagine, and that's the only people we will take on in multiple areas who can speak about life with authority because they've lived it. We want to build school scholarship programs, and we want to help the kids grow and mentor them and get new mentors in and just build something worthwhile that's going to leave a legacy long after we're not here.
That's awesome. Now that the film, I guess, is in the can, what's next for you?
Well, I've got my own film sort of in pre-production with George and with Kennedy Miller. A lot of it, of course, will hinge on the success of this movie. That's how films work. You know, so we'll see what the journey brings us at the other end. So but now it's the Team Infinity speaking. That's our thing. We're doing our first show on the 22nd of March up here on the Central Coast, and trying to basically show and give the key points and the key steps to the audience so they can make a change in their life. Because there's a lot of people that can talk it up and hype it up. We want to give you the steps to make it so that you can actually do it. Because everyone on my speaking team started with nothing and went on to build 20, 30, 40 million dollar companies, became Everest Summiteers, Academy Award winners, international rock and roll stars. So everyone has, their journey has been something quite extraordinary. And that's what we want to give back because we've started with very, very humble beginnings.
Wow. Greg, I'm just curious. You had this fear of public speaking for years, but yet you're working with A-listers like Charlize Theron and other actors. Did you find it difficult to do that?
No, the reason I don't find it difficult to do that and work with them is because when they're on my set, I own the set. I don't care what people think they are in terms of A-list actors or this or that. When they're on my set, or if I'm running a shooting range, or if I'm teaching them how to fight, I'm in charge. But we always make it fun. I don't talk to people in terms of being very famous or not famous. I think everyone's the same. We're people. And if you've done well in something, you're either very hardworking or you may have been slightly fortunate, but still it takes work. But at the end of the day, when you get over that fact of someone being in the limelight, like having, you know, I've met some of the biggest actors in the world and worked with them, but it doesn't matter. They're just people. And if you treat them as just people and not like a big star, everyone responds better because otherwise they put up a barrier.
George Miller is quoted. He said, "I've witnessed firsthand the way Greg can completely transfer his mastery of one area into another where he has no experience and become a master of that new area in a very little time." What would your advice be to someone who is in that situation?
Okay, it's reapplication of knowledge. What are you good at now? So if you're good at something, be it soccer or building or whatever it might be, you take what you know from that and try and apply those building blocks to the next thing and try and find a mentor if you can, whatever it might be, to shave the time down. Because I went into Happy Feet with, I'd never done a CG movie. I had no idea about computers. I could use one program, like a Word program. That's all I knew. And George said, now you're the technical head of the film. Like, you're going to be the digital crowds director, the motion capture director of this movie. And I said, yeah, but I know nothing about it. He goes, yeah, but you'll figure it out. I sat in a room with a digital director who's talking in acronyms like BMOS, BobJects. And I got home and I said to my wife, I have no idea what I've just got myself into. But we worked it out. And you know how I did it? With honesty. I told all of the crew that I'd never done a CG movie. And work with me and together we will learn and do it. Same deal. I immersed myself in that world. I gave myself to it 100%. I would sleep there overnight sometimes and just learn, sit with the team when there was nothing to do, just even get them coffee, because I didn't put myself above anybody. And I just kept immersing myself in every facet of it. And by the end of Happy Feet 1, I was probably one of the world leaders in CG filmmaking.
Just put your foot right into it and keep going.
That's it. I mean, I call myself a deep end thinker. I'll throw myself in the deep end of the pool and I'll drown until I find out how to swim. And that's just how I am in life. I'll say yes to something before I know the details, because if you spend too much time thinking about the details, you'll talk yourself out of it before you get started. You know, the great thing about everyone on my team, Infinity, is they've just gone, yeah, I'll do that. You know, Bocchi was 20, 30 kilos overweight. He was unfit, fat. And someone came up to him and said, hey, we're climbing Everest in a year's time. You're coming. And he'd just gone through a massive divorce and all kinds of things. And he went, yeah, okay, I'm there. But the work that went into that, if you see him training in gas masks with his nose and mouth taped up so he could barely breathe, and every experience they put him through to make him strong enough to climb the summit, I mean, you'd nearly fall over. But that's the dedication it takes. You have to immerse yourself in the world. Nothing else has to matter. You've got to put yourself there and just go for it no matter what the cost, because there's going to be hard times. But if you're prepared for the hard times, you'll always come out on top.
Greg, how can people get a hold of you?
Well, they can grab us on our Team Infinity website on www.teaminfinity.com.au. Get me on email if you want to, greg@gregvanborsum.com. I'm more than happy to help and talk to anybody that's willing to listen and willing to take advice, because it's a two-way street. I learn as much from other people as they will from me, and usually more.
Greg Van Borsum, it's been an honor, a privilege, an inspiration, and a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Greg, and I'm looking forward to speaking on stage with you one day too.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.